So, if with your permission, welcome to our class, our Basic Judaism series, and this is a little mini-series from failure to happiness. Last week was failure, everyone looks much happier this week. And next week we're going to be teaching, we're going to be studying about the Purim story, which is actually a very happy and joyous story, but it actually started out quite sad and pretty awful for our ancestors in ancient Persia. So come next week for that as well. I would like to dedicate, with your permission, this class to our many Jewish brothers and sisters in the Ukraine and our many non-Jewish brothers and sisters in the Ukraine who are really fighting for their lives and for their country. It's an unprecedented, crazy time that we're living in. And I've been sending out and doing a lot of posting. I hope some of you have been seeing any of this stuff, just to keep us abreast of what's going on. If anyone's interested, also I did an interview of Ina Vernikov, who's a Ukrainian councilwoman from Brooklyn, who used to come to MGE very often before she got into politics. And I did a podcast with her on the Wildcast, just giving us like an update of what's happening. It's really important to stay on top of things and to really contribute. There's a huge humanitarian crisis, as you know. This is going to be probably the largest refugee build-up crisis since the Second World War. It's already 1.2 million refugees that are pouring out of the Ukraine. Lots of people would like to get out. So with your permission, I'd like to dedicate the Torah that we study, that we discuss tonight, to all those people in the Ukraine. We believe that there's power when we get together and learn something, and we tap into some spiritual wisdom from a higher place and bring it down to this place. And if we can dedicate that to all of those Ukrainians, I think that would be really appropriate. So I want to start with a story that I saw in one of my favorite author's books, on the big Malcolm Gladwell guy, if you guys
That's
like
great.
Unbelievable.
What's your favorite one?
So, Outliers is probably my favorite book.
Have you read David and Goliath?
Yes.
That's incredible.
I've read all of his stuff. He's incredible. And so he tells the story of this guy, Dr. Stuart Wolf. Stuart Wolf was the head of the University of Oklahoma's Department of Medicine. And this pretty prominent professor of medicine was giving a lecture in a small town in Pennsylvania called Rosetta. And after he gave his medical talk, he went out to the local pub to get a beer with some of the doctors. And as they were just shooting the breeze, talking about what it's like to practice medicine in Rosetta, Pennsylvania, the doctor that he was having a beer with told him that in his 17 years of practicing medicine in this little small rural town, he rarely found anyone under the age of 65 with heart disease. Now that might not sound so crazy, but this was the 1950s. And if anybody has any sense of what was happening in the 1950s and heart disease, they were like an epidemic throughout the United States. This is before the wonderful cholesterol-lowering drugs that we have today that have really increased life expectancy. They used to call the husband killer, because there were so many men that would just die from these terrible heart attacks in their 50s, 60s, and when Wolf heard this, he couldn't believe what he was hearing. So he called in some of his colleagues and some of his medical students from the University of Oklahoma, and they began an extensive study of the people of Rosetta. And it was an easy town to study because it was very small. And they went literally house to house, speaking to everyone over the age of 21. They took blood samples, they brought in sociologists, they conducted a very thorough investigation of the entire population, tiny town, a couple thousand people. And listen to what they discovered. In the 1950s, early, sudden, or premature death was virtually unheard of. And again, at that time, that was like a crazy thing. There was also no suicide. There was no alcoholism, no drug addiction, and almost no crime. And not one person in Rosetta was on welfare. It was a really boring place to live. it was bizarre. And they tried to figure out what accounted for this very healthier lifestyle. The life expectancy was much significantly greater than in other places, and they almost didn't need the police. Nobody was on welfare. So they started ruling out factors. What's the first thing people look at? Diet. Right? So here's what they found about the diet of the people of Rosetta. This is all from Malcolm Gladwell, and I did my own research afterwards because I put it in my book and I needed more information. The people of Rosetta shared the same unhealthy dieting or exercise habits of the surrounding areas in the 1950s. People were not working out. Everybody belongs to a gym today or goes running or does something. In the 1950s, 41% of the people of Rosetta's calorie intake was from fat. They regularly cooked from lard.
Whoa.
Nobody was doing yoga or jogging. Many of them smoked heavily, struggled with obesity, and yet the death rate from heart disease was less than half the national rate. And they couldn't figure it out. What accounted for this phenomenon? It was crazy. So does anybody know the most popular course ever taught in, I guess, arguably the best university in the United States, at Harvard? The most popular course at Harvard today is a course on happiness.
Yeah.
Taught, of course, by a Jew by the name of Tal Ben Shachar, who's a visiting professor from Israel. He wrote the book on happiness. And the largest, fastest growing section, and I know this because when I wrote my first book, I tried getting it. It's in Barnes and Nobles. But I could not get it into the self-help section of Barnes and Nobles. I got it into the religion section of Barnes and Nobles. It's there now. You can go on 81st and Barnes. But I couldn't get it into self-help because the self-help section is ridiculously, it's the fastest growing. They keep taking up more and more tables, and it just grows and grows and grows. Every book is written on some permutation about happiness. In 2008, this is when the happiness craze started in America. In that 1 year alone, there were over 4,000 books published in the United States on the topic of happiness. And yet, study after study reveals that our generation, Americans, consider themselves less happy than ever before. I'm going to quote from Psychology Today, which is a very well-reputed journal. Quote, as a nation, we have grown sadder and more anxious during the same years that the happiness movement has flourished. Despite our generation being more focused than ever on achieving happiness, and despite the fact that we live a standard of life that was unimaginable by our great-grandparents, there are more stress-related illnesses in America than ever before. The United States, which is the most prosperous and affluent country in the world, okay, consumes more than 75% of the world's antidepressants. The suicide and depression rates have gone up. They got worse during COVID. And all the studies tell us that we're less happy. And the question is why? Because we always thought that if you had economic prosperity and you could earn a living and you weren't worried about where your next meal came from, then you were okay. That's kind of the dream, the American dream, you know, that we were sold. And one thing which is really interesting from all the studies, which is abundantly clear, that there is little or no relationship between money and happiness. Now that doesn't mean you don't need some money to be happy. I'm going to make it clear. Research shows that provided a person has their basic needs, food, shelter, clothing, and you're not worried about food, shelter, clothing, okay? More money and affluence is not a determining factor for happiness. And as one of my professors of psychology from Yeshiva University, where I studied, I was just a psych major, but Dr. Pelkowitz is a phenomenal professor, and he said it best. He had a great line. He said that the guy sitting on a public bus on his way to his blue-collar job is no less happy than the man riding beside him on the road, sitting in his chauffeured limousine on the way to a seven-figured salary position. There's no difference in levels of happiness. If the guy holding the brown bag on the way to his, let's say, construction job, is not worried about where his next meal or, you know, rent check is going to come from. So if money is not really producing happiness, then what is? So what is the Hebrew word for joy or happiness? Anybody know?
Osher.
Simcha. Osher means richness, riches.
Simcha. That's with ayin.
Yes.
With aleph is happiness.
The biblical term is simcha. The biblical term is simcha. It is also used, but not in the Torah.
Right.
In rabbinic also, in rabbinic literature also, that word is. But simcha is a word used throughout the Torah, always in context with a certain phrase. Lifnei Hashem. Those are two other words, before God. It says it a number of times in the Bible, in the Torah, Vesamachta lifnei Hashem, and you will be joyous before God. And it also says, Vesamachta becha gecha, and you will be happy in your holiday. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, one of the great rabbis of the 20th century, taught that there's an intrinsic connection in Judaism between being in the presence of God and being in a state of simcha, of joy. Now, when was a Jew in the presence of God? So you say, well, we're always in the presence of God. God's everywhere. Okay, but there are certain spots where you can feel God a little more, or where we believe God's presence dwells. That was where?
In the garden?
Well, the Garden of Eden, that's true when, you know, I guess that's before our existence, like first man in the Garden of Eden. That's when there was prophecy and God was communicating with people.
Moses?
But in the days of Moses, what was Moses told by God to build that would allow God's presence to reside amongst the nation? The temple, and before the temple was the Mishkan, the tabernacle, which these last couple of parshiot we've been reading about, six parshas related to the tabernacle. God says, Vasul Mikdash, make for me a sanctuary, v'shachanti v'tocham, and I will dwell with them. But what is it about being in the sanctuary, the tabernacle, the temple, let's say today our synagogues, right? We don't have a temple, we don't have a centralized temple like we used to in Jerusalem. The precursor of that was the tabernacle. We have our synagogues, which are supposed to be sort of miniature replicas of the temple of old. When was the Jew lifnei Hashem, before God? And that is, and when, and we say v'samacht b'chagecha, and you will be happy in your holiday. What are the holidays? So we have a holiday called Purim. It's coming up, but that's not a biblical holiday. What are the three biblical holidays that the Torah tells us?
Passover,
Shavuot, and Sukkot. And when the Torah says, "V'samach v'lifnei Hashem," you'll be happy before God. It's specifically referring to Jews coming to the temple in Jerusalem when? On one of those three holidays. Because what is also common to those three holidays? They are all pilgrimage holidays. They're all holidays where the Jew is expected to leave their home, go with their family to the temple, bring the special sacrifices, special offerings, and celebrate the holiday with your family in the temple.
Okay.
And in that state, they were obligated to be within the mitzvah of simcha. V'samacht b'chagecha. You go, you schlep with your family, you go to the temple, and there you are, happy and joyous. The question is, what would create that feeling? Because I want to know what they were... I want to know what they were smoking. No, I want to know what they were experiencing in the temple that was supposed to bring about this simcha, this joy. So I want to read you something from the great writings of Maimonides. For those of you unfamiliar, the great Rambam lived in the 1100s. He was originally from Spain and then eventually made his way to Egypt. He was a great physician and scientist and philosopher, and he was the first ever to basically codify all of the oral tradition, which was in the Talmud, and put it into an organized book, which he called the Mishneh Torah. And I'm going to read a little excerpt from it about the mitzvah to be happy on the holiday. Listen to what Maimonides wrote. I'll read it in Hebrew, I'm going to translate it. It says the following. He says, V'chayev Adam liot bahem sameach v'tov lev. He's talking about a person within his family. A person should be happy on the holidays. He and his wife and his children. Because the verse in the Torah says, v'samach v'chagecha, you shall be happy on the holiday. Ketzad. He says, how? What do you do? What makes you so happy on these holidays? So he says, haktanim. Well, let's talk about the children first. How do you make your kids happy on the holiday? So very, he says, notin lahem klayot, the egozim migdanot. You should give to the children klayot, egozim migdanot. You should give them almonds and sweets. Right? You ever go to a synagogue and there's like the candy man and he's giving out a little sugar rush for the kids. That's how you get kids excited to come to shul. It's not like children love to pray, but they like the candy. And I had a candy, how many of you guys had a candy man in shul? We got to be careful, some of these guys, but I think they have a contract.
It sounds really disturbing.
I know, it sounds very disturbing. When I grew up, it was like a very normal thing, but like today, you can't say that. Man giving out candies to small children, that doesn't sound good. But I will say, though, I used to always think they had a deal with the dentist, you know, because... Okay, so anyway, you give kids a little candy. V'hanashim, what about the women? How does a husband make his wife happy vis-a-vis the holiday? Kone lahem begadim, a husband should buy for his wife clothing. The tachshitim na'im, this is all, he's quoting all this from the Talmud. And fine jewelry, kithim amano, according to his means. Right? He doesn't have to break the piggy bank, but he should spend something and buy his kids some sweets, buy his wife something nice to wear, maybe some jewelry. And what about the men? What about the guys? What do we get? V'hanashim, ochlin basar, the men eat meat, v'shos in yayin, and drink wine. She'ein simcha l'vasav, ein simcha l'vayayin. He's quoting the Talmud, because there's only can only be joy if it's accompanied with meat and with wine. Now, he's not finished. Kids get the sweets. The wives get the clothing, the jewelry. The men get something nice to eat, to drink. U'kisho'ocha v'shosa. And when a person is eating and drinking on the holiday, he has to also make sure that who else gets to eat and drink. Okay, the ger is the stranger, referring specifically to someone who's converted to Judaism and may not be in so much with everybody else. Yatom is an orphan. Almana is a widow. Im sha'ar ha'aniyim ha'malim, together with the rest of poor people or those who are down and out. Aval, however, says the Rambam, Misha Noel Dalto Chatzero, somebody who sort of dresses up his own courtyard. V'ochel v'shosa, and he eats and he drinks. Hu ubana v'ishto, he, his children and his wife, and they're having a beautiful holiday together. V'eino machel u'mashke laniyam, but he doesn't give food or drink to poor people. V'lamri nefesh, and to those who are embittered souls. Ein lo simchas mitzvah, that is not the joy found in a mitzvah. El simchas kreso, it's just the joy found in your belly. Simchas kreso means the joy of your tummy. Now think about this for a minute. It says something very, very powerful. What is producing this joy? And I'm going to distinguish in a minute from joy to happiness. I'll get to it in a minute. But stay with me. And my talk is not so long, I'll stop and then we'll open it up for conversation. So, what are the things that are bringing about the simcha, this joy? So first of all, let's take it apart, let's break it down. What are the activities that go into celebrating the holiday, according to Maimonides? What are they? So first of all, you have to take a trek with your family. It's a schlep. Right? You have to pack up, bring the kids, and go. And you could be living somewhere else in Israel at the time. You might be living in ancient Babylonia, which is quite a trek. And what were you doing when you got to the temple? I mean, there was praying going on. There were sacrifices being brought. And it cost. I mean, anybody who's going to get ready for Passover, which is just in a couple of weeks, it costs money. Right? And to buy the matzah, to clean your home. I mean, everything is costly. You have to buy the kosher food. Kosher food always costs more. Always costs more money. So you're making this long, sometimes arduous trip with your family to Jerusalem. You're bringing something of value to the temple, upon the altar. Parents are buying their kids sweets. Husband is buying his wife jewelry, clothing. He's getting something to eat and drink too. Plus, you're sharing all of this with a less fortunate, an indispensable part of the mitzvah. What is creating simcha, my friends? What's creating the joy? Simcha, what's the common denominator of all of these activities? They're all things struggle. You're doing. A little struggle.
Celebrating together.
There's together, and you're extending yourself for who? First of all, for your family, A, and B, beyond your circle, beyond your inner circle of family, right? Simcha is created by doing things for other people, not for ourselves. And this is also a little of a mistake I think many of us make. When we are lacking simcha in our lives, we often, and it makes sense, and I do this myself, I don't walk around with a smile always, okay? We all have our stuff. But we often imagine that if I'm upset, it must be because I've neglected something about me. If I paid a little more attention to me, if I pampered myself a little more, I'll get myself out of this funk. So much of what we do to try to make ourselves happy revolves around ourselves. We book a vacation, we sign up for a yoga class, we get a massage, we pamper ourselves. By the way, nothing wrong with any of those things. And everybody needs to do some of that. I want to be clear. But those things may help reduce stress. And they may even give us a little level of joy. But it's pleasure joy. It's not happiness joy. Happiness joy lasts. Pleasure joy is fleeting. You know, I used to really be into ties for many years. Just neckties. And they went out of... I don't know, they didn't become as popular to wear neckties. I still wear, I have like too many because of that time. I just love neckties. Just love them. And when I would get down, I would buy myself a tie. It was just like a quick picnic. It made me feel good. Especially when I went out like fundraising for MJE. I often go Midtown. That's where a lot of my donors are. I would go to see them and maybe I'd come out and didn't do as well as I would like to, you know. And then like there's a guy selling ties on the corner. And I'd come up with a tie or I'd go into a shop and those are dangerous. And I come home and my wife would see, she would see like a new tie. She's like, I'm sorry, you got turned down, right? You know, she could tell it was, I don't even know what to call it. It's like people do this, that you could shop to make yourself feel a little better. What is it?
Hedonistic.
Well, yeah, it is a little hedonistic, but there's a term for it. With shopping, people, I mean...
Attention, retail therapy.
I'm looking for something a little nicer than attention. That's a little harsh. Retail therapy, okay, I like that. Okay. So, now the truth is, when I bought that tie and I put it on, it actually made me feel good.
Yeah.
And when I put it on the hanger and then I put it on the next week, it also made me feel good. But then, of course, it's sort of a diminishing point of return when it comes to physical pleasure. The more you engage in it, the less it seems to, and pretty soon the tie did nothing for me. Now, the common denominator of all of those activities, we said that there's simcha from giving to others and getting out of ourselves. Those activities which get ourselves out of ourselves and bind us to God, to other people, that create community. The trek to Jerusalem, the buying the gifts for other people, right, doing for ourselves reduces stress, gives us a little joy and pleasure, but it's fleeting. It's never going to create real happiness for the long term. Lasting happiness has to come from living a life of purpose and meaning, which has to involve yourself getting out of yourself and being part of something bigger than yourself. I read you an excerpt from a letter that I saw in one of the writings of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, of blessed memory. He said that somebody wrote a letter to the late and great Lubavitch Rebbe. Listen to this letter. A very sad letter that went something like this. It was a student of the Rebbe, of the great Chabad Schneerson. He said, I would like the Rebbe's help. I wake up each day sad and apprehensive. I can't concentrate. I find it hard to pray. I keep the commandments, but I find no spiritual satisfaction. I go to synagogue, but I feel alone. I begin to wonder, what is life about? I need help. And you know what the Rebbe's response was? He wrote back a letter. It didn't contain a single word. He took his student's letter, and and just circled the first letter of each sentence, which was the word I. And he said, here is the problem. It's I. There's only one book Rabbi Sacks wrote in all of Tanakh, in all of biblical scripture, that uses the first person singular so many times, I, and that is Sefer Kohelet, the book of Ecclesiastes that King Solomon wrote. I built for myself, I planted for myself, I acquired for myself. No other book in Tanakh uses the I so many times, and that, says Rabbi Sacks, was Kohelet's problem, Solomon. He kept thinking about himself. He was rich, he was powerful, but at that point in his life, at least, he was not happy. And guess what? When they started digging deeper into that small rural town in Rosetta, Pennsylvania, to discover why people's lifespans were significantly longer, why there was no suicide, no drug addiction, no alcohol problems, like in so many other parts of the country, they discovered something very, very sweet and simple. Rosetta, Pennsylvania was settled by a group of immigrants from southern Italy in the late 1800s, a place called Rosetta in Italy. And what they brought with them from Italy was a tremendous sense of community. Number one, they were very faith-oriented. Almost everyone in town attended Mass every Sunday. There were huge amounts of volunteering in town. They counted 22 separate civic organizations in a population less than 2,000. Which means that everybody in town was involved in some sort of volunteering, like consistently. And there was a tremendous sense of responsibility of one person to the next. The senior citizens would sit on their rocking chairs. They would see a kid in high school cutting class. They knew who he was. They knew who his parents were. They'd take him by the ear and bring him back to the principal's office. Everybody knew each other's names. The researchers saw how Rosettans would stop on the corner and schmooze with each other, you know, during the day. They saw how many homes had three generations living under one roof and how much respect grandparents commanded. And then something changed. And that was the 1980s, and I remember the 1980s. The 1980s, they called it the Me Generation. It was a generation because if you know anything about the 60s and then the 70s, it was all about causes and about getting involved in these bigger-than-life issues and the big anti-Vietnam, at least in this country, and a lot of the rock and rollers that the 1970s produced was coming out of that culture. And then the 80s hit. The music definitely plummeted in the 80s. I just remember that, in my opinion. But in the 1980s, as the new generation somehow became more Americanized, they started to reject the old Italian folkways. They even changed the architecture of their homes because they had more money now. So instead of front porches, they put in another garage because they had a second car. And now you could live next door to someone, like we do here in the city all the time, and not know your next door neighbor's name or the names of their kids because there's a big garage blocking you. I know we don't think of it that way, but if you're sitting on your rocker and you just see, but now there's all this other material stuff that's in the way now. And people started focusing on their own issues. Religion went down, volunteering went down, people began to spend more time on their own stuff. And today, Rosetta, Pennsylvania has one of the highest death rates of heart disease of that part in Pennsylvania. No different than any other place. And truth be told, this happened all over the country. Between the 1970s and the 1990s, there was a marked decline in attendance in public meetings and in civic organizations throughout the country. There's a great book called Bowling Alone, written by Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam, if you've ever seen that book. And in the book he talks about, it sounds silly, like bowling. You know, my father-in-law, blessed memory, when I met him for the first time, he was wearing a bowling shirt, just came from bowling practice. I was like, I never knew anybody on a bowling team, but he's like, you have no idea, it's a whole world. People were on these bowling teams with the shirts and the bowling balls, and it was like a whole, I don't know, it was like a whole subculture. People who bowled, okay? And he calls this, Putnam calls this phenomenon bowling alone. Because he says that in the 1980s, there were just as many people bowling as there were before, but less were joining teams. More people were bowling by themselves. And the point obviously is very clear. It seems as though if we want to be besimcha, joy, let this thing go off. If we want to be with joy, we need to get out of ourselves. Now there are other factors. I don't mean to oversimplify that help produce happiness, lower expectations, being more grateful. There are a lot of other factors. But existentially, if we want to be happy, we need to be living as part of a community where people care about each other. We need to volunteer for causes in which we believe. We need to attend services so that we can connect with a being that is greater than ourselves. And we need to give of ourselves. It's an amazing, amazing line. I just want to quote here. From Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, who was one of my teachers. He said the following. He says, the more concerned we are with our own happiness, the less likely we are to achieve it. And that explains it, because there was never a happiness movement in our grandparents or great-grandparents, and they were happier. And nobody wrote books about being happy. And nobody was, and there were less, and they had less money, and they had less opportunity. And we're running after it, because what we need to be really running after is a life of purpose and meaning. And a life of purpose and meaning means you get yourself out of yourself, into causes beyond yourself. And that somehow makes us happier. Because I really believe we are hardwired. We are hardwired to feel better when we do for other people. And if you took $1 million right now and you spent it on yourself, and you took that same $1 million and you spent it on someone else, although most of us would probably spend it on ourselves, or the bulk of it on ourselves, we would feel better. We would be happier people spending it on others. We just are. I know this personally. When my kids were little, we always had these like Sunday, I don't want to say fights, but like we had 4 kids, everyone wanted to do something else. Sunday is the day off, right? So this kid wanted to do this, this kid wanted to do that. And those few Sundays where my wife and I had the strength to just put our foot down and say, here's what we're doing. And we would just take them to a soup kitchen. And they would either cut onions in the kitchen or serve people. There's a beautiful restaurant in Brooklyn called Masbia, which serves for free food, kosher food for people that are poor. When we would do that, like the feeling that that engendered within my family and the feeling that my kids had about themselves was like so much better than all the other fun, nice things that we would otherwise do with them on a Sunday here in Manhattan. There's just something about doing for someone else that just cuts it. And I'm arguing that we should do it selfishly. We always say, well, I'll do it because it's the right thing. No, do it because it's going to make you happier. That's the way God created us. That we would feel really good when we extended ourselves for other people. And Rabbi Lamb says that the more concerned we are with our own happiness, the less likely we are to achieve it. The sages and the ethics of our fathers teach, if I am for myself, who am I? The true simcha is attained only when I lose myself, only when my concern is in making others happy. That's why the mitzvah of simcha is in the Torah is coupled with the mitzvah to provide joy for the poor, for the widow, and for the orphan, because to be happy means we have to stop trying to make ourselves happy and start by taking care of others. That, he writes, will bring true happiness. And if you think about it, most of Jewish tradition is really intended to develop this kind of existence. The sages speak of the three pillars of the Jewish faith. I was just talking to somebody about this today. Shabbat, Kashrut, and the laws of family purity. So if you think about each of those three areas of Jewish tradition, Shabbat demands that we rest in a way which binds us to others in our community. And you're all welcome to be here and join us. Any Shabbat, FNL, Friday night, Saturday mornings, 9:30, you feel a sense of being part of something greater. People are eating meals with each other. It's just this great community. Kashrut challenges us to eat, but not simply based on what we like, but in accordance with the divine set of principles, so that this mundane activity of eating gets elevated to connect us with something higher. And finally, Taharat HaMishpacha, the laws of family purity, which play a critical role in sexual intimacy between husband and wife, is just as much about satisfying one's partner as it is about oneself. And not to mention the central role that chesed, giving, occupies, performing acts of loving kindness, occupies in Jewish life, to help our friends when they're in need, to make happy. When you go to a wedding, I went to a wedding yesterday. The mitzvah of going to a wedding isn't just to drink and have a good old time. It's to make the bride and groom happy. To escort the dead, God forbid, if somebody passes away, to be there for a friend, to open up your home, to provide hospitality for strangers. It's an unbelievable phenomena that the more we do for others, the more we get ourselves out of ourselves, the happier we'll become. I'm going to end with one story about a gentleman I will never forget. His name is Yosef Nachmias. I brought him to speak to our group at MGE on our trip to Israel a bunch of summers ago, before your trip with us. It was probably 10 years ago. He spoke to our group and he told us that at the age of 14, he was an Iraqi Jew. And they told me that he's going to be very hard to hear and his English is terrible. But he's got an unbelievable story. So I said, fine, everybody will just listen hard and we'll get through the broken English. And he told us that when he was 14, he joined the British Army to fight the Germans. Because, if you're familiar with this, but they thought Germany in the Second World War was going to come to the Middle East. And there were about 30,000 Jews that joined the British Army to prepare and to battle the Nazis. It never happened, but they got trained. 3 years later, when he was 17, he joined the Irgun, which was the Jewish Freedom Fighters, a Jewish underground led by Menachem Begin, to fight against the British. He told us he had to have his tooth removed and replaced with a gold one so he could better impersonate Arabs. He had a choice. He either could impersonate a Brit or an Arab. And he was from Iraq. He looked more Arab. So he had his tooth taken out and replaced with a gold one. And he was telling us these stories. And he had this little smirk on his face as he was telling us these stories. He was part of this famous operation to break free 8 Jewish fighters who were supposed to be hung by the British. And as I listened to him speak, I could not notice how... He was smiling the whole time. He had this look of total contentment. He was well into his 90s. And it became clear to me how happy he was because he had lived his life for a cause greater than himself. And there's no question that this man had so much more stress in his life. Probably not a lot of what we would call joy, but a lot of happiness. A lot of long-term happiness. Not much fleeting joy. And the truth is, because we're a composite of body and soul, if we only pursue pleasure, so we feed the body, but then the soul goes hungry, and we become unhappy. Money and material things may make our bodies feel good. They feed the physical part of who we are. But connecting to God and taking care of other people, getting ourselves into the world of ideas, of wisdom, of Torah, devoting ourselves to causes and to other people, that, my friends, feeds the soul. And that puts us before God, lifnei Hashem, besamachta lifnei Hashem, and you will be happy before God. And I thought I would share that as an idea. Also, in the zechut, in the honor of everyone in the Ukraine, because to the degree that we can be involved and do something, even if it's when you go home tonight, going online and making a donation. I posted it on my Facebook page, a link that you can donate to contribute to any of the lots of different groups that are collecting money for humanitarian aid, to be more focused on other people and to try to think about ways of getting into higher ideas and taking the focus a little off ourselves and on Hashem, other people, and causes in which we believe. That is going to produce much more than a fleeting joy, but beyond the instant, I called it, kind of happiness. And that's really my blessing to all of us. We do this within reason. You can take anything to the extreme. So I've met people who only do this and don't pay enough attention to their own personal needs. That's not good either. That's unhealthy. You have to have the right kind of balance. But I feel if we can invest ourselves that much more in things beyond ourselves, we'll find true simcha, true joy for the long run. Any comments or questions? I'm done. Please.
I just wanted to say that in my spiritual studies, no matter what tradition you're in, they always emphasize gratitude and service. Those are the two main things. To step 100%. Outside of yourself and do service for other people. And so I really enjoyed what you had to say.
I appreciate that. You know, gratitude is another area of which I didn't focus on tonight. Being able to be grateful for the things you have, and not putting too much of your eggs in the if and when basket. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't have dreams and we shouldn't have ambitions and goals, but there's so many things that we already have that we can find joy in. That also is a great contributing factor to long-term happiness. 100%. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
So let me ask you about receiving, because I know in the Torah there are several times when we're so joyed because we're receiving. Like, for example, when we receive the Torah, when we receive the miracles and the evil, the cross, when we receive reeds. You don't talk about that. I'm just curious why. Because I feel like for me, I agree with you. I'm very thrilled when I give something. But sometimes when I give it, I don't receive. There's an imbalance. And then you feel like you're giving too much, and then you feel the lack of reciprocity.
So, like I said at the very end, 100%, you can't just keep giving. And I hope I didn't, because I spent the whole time talking about giving, I hope I didn't imply that we shouldn't take. We all need. We're all people in need also.
Right.
I'm just saying that I don't think we can get the kind of happiness that we're looking for by receiving, whether it's something that we give ourselves or something that we get from a friend or a colleague. There is also a... you know, being grateful about what we do receive and not feeling badly about it. I mean, it's a good thing to take. As long as we're not constantly taking and taking and looking at all the gifts we have as that's going to make me happy. And therefore, if I have more of those gifts, I'll be happier. You know, and if I'm unhappy, it must be because I'm not getting enough. I wonder how often we ask whether or not we're giving enough. Maybe that's a reason why I'm not as happy as I could be. You know, but again, it's a balance. And this gets into a little of a subjective, loosey-goosey area here. It's different for everybody. And it's different depending on the part of your life. Somebody might be more needy emotionally, but be very, you know, not very needy when it comes to, let's say, material things. Right? I'm sure you know somebody like that, who just like, I don't need a lot physically to be happy. I don't need like great clothing. Da, da, da. Other people really have a tremendous need, but they're a little more self-sustaining emotionally. Everybody's different. You have to kind of size up your friends. I was going to say size yourself up, but and have a balance. You do have to have a balance. Are you referring to anything more specific?
No, I mean, I was just thinking, because a lot of the examples that you gave are certainly true, but like in terms of like the Jewish people, like a lot of us, like we're thrilled because we are given Shabbat, we are thrilled because we are given the Torah.
We are given a lot.
And in that case, I mean, it's not necessarily our actions that are making us happy, but rather what we are receiving.
Right. So that's where the gratitude comes in, I think. I think that's where the gratitude, that's a whole other class. That's why anybody know what we do as Jews to make sure that we stay grateful? Prayer and specifically blessings before we eat. We try not to eat anything, even drink anything, without acknowledging its source. Because there's so many things that we just consume and we don't even think about it. We also make a blessing when we come out of the bathroom. Because when was the last time going to the bathroom made you feel good? I don't mean physically. I mean feel good like you've got something going on great in your life. Going to the bathroom for most of us is just a nuisance. It's an annoyance that I have to just get so I can get back to my real life. But consider going to the bathroom as an opportunity to feel gratitude for that the plumbing is working. And, you know, we tend to only appreciate things when they're threatened. Mm-hmm. And then when we get it back, we're like, oh, what Judaism wants us to do is appreciate the blessings while we have them. And a great way to do that is to make a blessing before you consume anything. That's what the Talmud says, that before we enjoy anything from the physical world, we should make a bracha. Now, that's not because God needs a pat on the back. That's because we, by acknowledging God as the source of that, that is going to make me feel like I've got some really good things going on in my life. When was the last time you actually said, going to the bathroom and drinking a cup of water, that's going to bring me some joy? We don't, because we're constantly putting our joy in things we don't have. Yeah, both of you guys.
Two things.
Fight it out.
You mentioned from the earth, so is it Adma for the water?
Say again?
You said from the earth, so is the blessing for water
No, no. The blessing for water is Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nihyeh Bidvaro. Which means everything is according to his name, is according to his word. The adama is for vegetables, like a potato or a tomato.
Before you drink or after you drink?
Before. Okay. Always before.
Second question. If you have a Jewish brother or sister that's clearly miserable, what's a way to help them not be so miserable?
Well, there might be a looming traumatic issue. You know, I just...
You talked about being plugged into something bigger than yourself to try to get away from the eye into the sun, Hashem.
Yeah, you just have to be careful, because if somebody is really upset about a certain thing, mm-hmm. you don't want to just ignore it and say, stop paying attention to that.
Right.
You know, you want to acknowledge it and let the person feel validated for what they're feeling, but then that can't go on forever. In fact, well, let's say you go visit somebody in the hospital. I had to go visit somebody recently in the hospital. So there's a little of a difference, and I had to pay a shiva call. I had them both this week, unfortunately. So what's the difference between the way you speak to someone who has lost a loved one and someone who's, let's say, fighting an illness in the hospital? So the difference is that when you go visit somebody who's, let's say, is sitting shiva, who's mourning the loss of a loved one, you don't want to ignore the elephant in the room. You really want to just like ask questions about the person. What would they like? What are you feeling? Because the whole point of the shiva is really for them to express and acknowledge and really process their loss. That's the goal. Not so much when you go visit somebody in the hospital who's sick. If you spend the whole time talking about their illness, right? And that I'm on this medication, that, did you get the right that? The first thing you're supposed to do is make sure that they're getting the best medical care and then nursing care. Both are very important. And then afterwards, you want to distract them a little. Actually, you want to talk to them about other important things in their life, so they can put the sickness within a certain framework. Because otherwise, it's going to feel like the only thing that exists in their life is this illness. So, if it's a grandmother, you want to talk to them about their grandchildren. If it's a person who's an attorney, you want to talk to them about their practice. About other things going on, so they could take this illness, which is real, and they can put it within the context of other things in life and hopefully deal with it like that. So I think there's a difference. If a person experienced a trauma, God forbid, you don't want to ignore it and distract them and talk about everything else. You want to make sure they're getting help for that specific thing, and you just want to be there. It's a very famous phrase from the prophets, Imo Anochi Bitzara, I'm with you in your distress. That's your job. To get your brother to feel like you are feeling a little of his pain. That's A. And by the way, there are no words for that. That's why a lot of people pay a shiva call and they're like, ugh, I didn't say the right thing. There's no right thing. You just show up. And you try to empathize and try to get this other person to see that you're feeling a little of their pain. That's listen, when my mother passed away, that's what helped me. But if someone is just consumed with their own things and they really have a handle on it, but you want to try to get them out of themselves a little, then I think a little of what we discussed tonight would be helpful. And that's why most of the 12-step programs, mm-hmm. part of the therapy is that you have to help someone who's worse than you. Like you think you're down and out, meet this guy, and you got to help him. Part of the therapy of getting yourself out of whatever rut you're in is helping someone else who's in the same kind of rut or worse. Because we want to feel needed and we want to feel like we can help other people. That helps us. That's one of the smartest things about these 12-step programs is that everybody's required to be there for somebody else. That's not just an altruistic thing. That's a psychological reality. That we're helped when we help others. Great question. Any other comments, questions? Yes, please.
A couple comments here. The first thing I thought about was the idea that if you had $1 million and you spent it on yourself,
right,
on someone else, I think if you spent it on yourself, you might immediately go into some level of, it really depends on what it is and how much you have, but shame, I think, could come out of your decision. Especially, that's, shame can be something for as simple as doing the wrong action, you regret it, you feel shame. But I think that if you do have someone else, it can also be a very good feeling. But,
I think it's contagious. The more you do it, the more you're going to want to do it. You just have to just start doing it. What's that?
Mitzvah.
Yeah, one mitzvah sort of eggs on another mitzvah. It just has that effect. I'm feeling very frustrated, honestly, with what's going on in the Ukraine, because I feel like I'm just sitting here, like, I write a little check, post some things, show that we care. But when you really feel like you've helped somebody, like in a bad situation, there's just nothing like it. All the money in the world cannot come near that pleasure, and that's kind of like a pleasure that sticks to the bones. You know what I mean? That lasts.
I did something that really did help. Oh,
like when I meet someone who used to come to MJE, and now they're like, and whether they're having some issue, and now they're just like in a better place in life, and they tell you that you were helpful to that. That's like, oh, I live for that stuff. It's just, we want to feel needed, and that we can matter to other people. I think that's really what it means to be part of a tight-knit community. This is a really good commercial for MGE, I have to tell you, because I realized for the first time many years ago that this organization was more than simply an organization. When there was a woman that lost, whatever, a woman at MGE lost her job, and a few other people came forward and said, did you hear so-and-so, she lost her job, she's so upset, maybe we can get together and talk, help this. And like, people just started using our community to help each other. And that was just like, that was like many, many years ago. And that's really what it means to be part of the community.
But I think you should at least address those of us who want to help, feel that we can help the world in a certain way, but we're stuck. So, I always look for the breakthrough. I happen to be comedian, but like a Jew, but like then I met a Buddhist, then I was all like, damn, these Buddhists have a point, and then, then I came back to the Jews, and now half-half, not really. But in the Ukraine scenario, I completely agree with you. If you could channel yourself right there and get between these two parties, fix it and end it, that would be the day. That would be
I would feel pretty good. Yeah, I would kill Putin, but I would just take him out. But obviously, it would be better if some peace could be achieved, and it would be great if we felt like we could do that. But there are a lot of Ukrainians living in New York City.
Yeah.
I just met somebody today, and whose parents are there, and they're freaking out. They're feeling very alone right now. Even Russians, right? What's that?
Many great Ukraine figures. Jewish came from Ukraine.
Oh my gosh.
Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Nachman, Lubavitch.
But to be fair, I listened to something called the Institute of Secular Humanistic Judaism last week. They spoke about the Ukraine in 1993, and they tell you the story from 1400 on, which is when Russia was originally born in Ukraine. And then there's been centuries and centuries of basically the Ukrainian people who stayed there are the Ukrainians, but the idea of Russia migrated over, and basically it's, it keeps happening, but there is some validity to a ruler in Moscow who thinks, I want to call these people my people. It's horrible. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just
right. Whatever it is, we just getting back to the topic at hand. The I just think it's important for everyone to find some cause to really devote themselves to, and I also to look at your Judaism as a way of getting yourself wrapped up into something beyond yourself. That's the difference between studying Torah and any other discipline. And I'm very into studying other disciplines. I think that Judaism very much wants us to appreciate human wisdom in whatever field you happen to go into. But the distinct advantage of studying Torah wisdom is that it comes from a higher place. And it just has a way of connecting you to something beyond yourself. And it just feels good to study Torah and to learn it and to try to, you know, incorporate some of its teachings into our lives. That's what we're doing when we're praying and we're studying and we're doing all these things. We're not just, you know, making ourselves all happier by, you know, getting some wisdom, but it's actually tying us into something beyond us. You may not always feel that in every class or every Jewish book that you read. And I'm not saying that other religions like Buddhism aren't tapping into that too, to some degree. But I think Judaism has an incredible, it's really a repository for this spiritual wisdom. That's not only enlightening on an intellectual level, but it gets us out of ourselves. And I think, I'm going to speak very autobiographically, I think the social media is making it harder for all this. And I'm very sucked into it because it's helpful for us at MGE. It's helpful for us in MGE, okay? But it's just keeping me too connected to, like, likes and other people. It's not, you know, unless you're really helping. Sometimes if I do a post, and then I feel like that post gave people some wisdom, and it gave people this, and it gave, I don't know. What's that?
Inspiration.
Some inspiration. You know, like anything else, it can go either way. It's just a tool. It's just a tool. It can go either way. But think about the Rosettans. Think about like how it actually prolonged their lives, made their lives better and healthier, because they were not focused on themselves alone. And I think we could learn a lot from that. You know, I'll tell you one last thing. The reason this story resonates with me is my Zadie, my father's father, was from Bialystok, which was now it's in Poland. It used to be in Russia. So he came to the United States with nothing, like a lot of people of that generation, a lot of our grandparents or great-grandparents. And he had a little store, and when I was a kid, I used to go help him in the store. I hardly ever saw any customers. You know, once in a while, that little bell, you know, the bell, letting you know somebody was coming into the store. This is very old school, the store. And whatever he couldn't sell in the store, he would peddle. And he was probably the poorest person I knew. And you know what we wrote on his tombstone? We put a phrase from the ethics of our fathers. He who is rich, Ezu Ashir, Asamech Bechelko. He who is happy with what he has. And he didn't work on it so much, he just was. I think that's something we have to work on. And I'm speaking to myself as I speak to you. Driven people often are crazy people and have a hard time learning to be happy with what they have.
That was the statement there, but happiness is wanting what you already have.
Or at least being satisfied with it, which is not a simple thing. And that doesn't mean, there's a very fine line between that, by the way, and, you know, aspirational goals. It's not like you just want to, like, stay the same your whole life and not try to really kill it in your business or whatever you do professionally. You want to do that, but you still at the same time want to be happy with the way things are right now. And not this if and when happiness. And we all kind of live a little of that if and when.
Yeah.
happiness. You know, and that's where blessings are very helpful. I find that incredibly helpful to make a little bracha. I'll bring in maybe Aliyah, if you can remind me for next week. If you guys come back, I will give you bli neder, something you'll be receiving. It's a little bracha packet.
Yes.
It's got the six blessings in it with the fruit. It's very nicely done. You can carry it around and you get used to saying brachot. But if you can actually think about it before you take the sip, before you bite into the pizza, whatever it is, I'm telling you, it just changes your whole attitude, and it makes a cup of water or going to the bathroom or any of these things, it actually makes it a meaningful experience. Something which fills the happiness tank a little. Because that tank seems to only get filled when we get things we currently don't have. And that is not a good recipe for life. Trust me. You don't want that being the only gauge of your happiness. Okay, next, any other questions, comments? Any other great pearls of wisdom here? All right, next week we're going to talk about Purim. And I want to mention also that besides studying about the Purim story, which is one of the most interesting stories in the Torah about Queen Esther and Haman and Ahasuerus, we're going to go through the whole story, try to make sense of it. When is Purim?
Purim is Wednesday night.
Next Wednesday night, a week from this Wednesday night. So we will be having a Purim party here with a tropical theme. You will need to come with some sort of tropical...
Hawaiian lake.
Yeah.
Is it a
bathing
suit party?
No, it's not a bathing suit party. It's going to be so embarrassing when you show up in your bathing suit next week. Hawaiian shirts, I don't know. Yeah, that kind of fun stuff. Can you pull that off? You can pull that off. So the event is going to be at 7 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken. We're going to begin it with a Megillah reading, an explanatory Megillah reading.
It's the baptism until 7:30.
And then we'll have a party. The MGE new band is going to be debuting.
New band?
We have a new band. None of the musicians are in this room right now, but they're quite good. I'll be in the back banging on the drums. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, they say you are here.
Yeah, I'm like the percussionist. They're not.
Yeah, but the drums are...
Yeah, they're in the back. So that'll be next Wednesday night. And anyone who's interested, also, we're having what's called a Purim Seuda, which is a Purim feast on Thursday afternoon at 6 o'clock, if anybody wants to come to that. There is a mitzvah on Purim, not only to hear the Megillah read, but also to partake of a feast. So we're going to be having that in this room next Thursday at 6, if anybody's interested. And FNL Friday Night Lights here, 6:30. Every Friday night and Saturday morning at 9:30, I will be giving a talk about Purim this coming Shabbat. I'm working on it now. Thank you all for being here. I hope you're all happier. Long-term happiness. All right, how do we turn this thing off now? Hey, guys, thank you for joining our friends on Instagram.
Oh, there's lots of them.